Welcome to Extreme Jeans on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
And welcome back, Jeanies. It is Extreme Jeans Family History Radio and ExtremeJeans.com. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, and it is good to be here. Since last time, some big news for the show. We can now be heard on iHeartRadio's brand new talk channel. Yes, the worldwide takeover of Extreme Jeans has begun. If you're not Furris, you're a Guinness. So please be sure to get your family and friends to our website, ExtremeJeans.com, and the show, of course, from wherever you are and however you're listening. You can now pretty much listen on your iAnything. For first-timers, the toll-free number to call the show is 1-234-56-GENES. That's toll-free, 1-234-56-GENES. And you can record your stories, comments, and questions there anytime, even when we're not on the air, and we'll be happy to get back to you and maybe get you on the show. We love your families of family tree discovery, so let us know about your finds. I am very excited about our guest today. It's a man named John Tippetts. John's going to be here in about 9 minutes. He is like any other genie, a curious guy who just wanted to know more, so he started looking. In this case, he was looking for information on his father, who died when John was young. Now, his dad had survived in the Alaskan wilderness for some time following an airplane crash during World War II. I mean, this is unbelievable. John wanted to know everything about it. He got a lot more than he bargained for, and we're excited to have John share the story of his dad's greatest life challenge coming up. And in keeping with John's father's harrowing adventure, our poll this week on ExtremeJeans.com is about crashes. Pretty much any kind of vehicle crash except road vehicle crashes. Now, were you or any of your family members ever in a train or plane crash? Now, my first thought was, and maybe yours is, well, how many people could say yes to that? But I was a passenger in a fatal train crash just outside of New York City in 1973, leaving Manhattan. Yeah, the engineer missed a signal, came into the Mount Vernon train station during rush hour, and slammed into a train already stopped there. One died, 47 were hospitalized, 104 were injured. I was fortunate not to be one of them. And my father was a co-pilot on a corporate plane that had its landing gear jammed, forcing a landing on a foamed runway in Boston in 1965. Everyone got out without injury. So I figure if there were two incidents in just my family, maybe there are others. So answer the poll either way. But if you have a story in your family history of plane or train crash survival or non-survival, let us know about it. Email me at fisher@extremejeans.com. And by the way, put the E on the front of extreme, or otherwise, if you go to the website, you're going to wind up going to the website of a horse breeding farm. It's true. Here is this week's family histoire news from the pages of extremejeans.com. Okay, I know Thanksgiving is over, but there was an outstanding story in the New York Times that I found on what it takes to join the Society of Mayflower Descendants. It's a really well-written piece that explains the challenges of getting through the preliminary application where the local chapter finds out if you really have half a clue as to what you're talking about as far as your line to Plymouth goes, to the full-fledged application where every link is examined, to the final approval and the presentation of the much-coveted certificate that says, basically, not only are you the honest-to-goodness descendant of a Mayflower passenger, but you are also relentless in your pursuit of that certification. And by the way, I just got one of those last month, and I got to tell you, artistically speaking, not so great. Needs work. But I like that it certifies the connection to these very interesting ancestors that every kid learns about in elementary school, related or not. The entire story is well done, and it's definitely worth a read. Find the link at extremejeans.com. Scientists cannot be happy this week. You know, they operate on theories that they go about trying to prove, and they spend a lot of money working these ideas. Well, then something comes along, and the theory's blown to smithereens. Now, we got two stories like that this week. The first is a story of a 24,000-year-old boy of about three from Siberia. I mean, he's from back that far. He was found by the Soviets back in the late 50s. Danish researchers came along and decided to do some DNA tests on the remains. A first test was worthless because of contamination by scientists back when DNA testing hadn't been thought of yet. And so they did another one. The essence of what they learned was this Siberian boy had ties to Western Europe and American Indians. Conclusion? Europeans were driven farther east during the last ice age than anyone had previously thought. The second thing they concluded was Native Americans weren't just Siberian East Asian. They're a mix of East Asian with those Europeans who got to Siberia. It's also from the New York Times, links at extremegenes.com. The second story, messing with scientists and how they make their living, is this one. Scientists in Spain have been able to obtain and analyze DNA from a thigh bone found in a cave. It's from a place they call the Pit of the Bones. The DNA is coming up as being 400,000 years old. That's way older than what has been presumed to have been the time of the earliest known human, by some 100,000 years. Anyway, this story involves Homo heidelbergensis, couldn't tell you what that means, and Neanderthals, which I recall as a very cliquish group at my high school years ago, wrestling team, I think. Anyway, scientists are having to put together this new theory on the movements of early man and just when was someone called a man. The article explains it all much better than I do, and what it really means is that scientists' cheese has been moved again, as they say. And finally, a copy of the earliest book ever published in what became the United States has been sold. It was published by Puritans in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1640 on a press that was brought over on a ship from London. It was their Book of Psalms. The Old South Church in Boston owned five copies of it. They shared three with the Library of Congress, Yale, and Brown University. They're keeping one, and they sold this one through Sotheby's for $14.2 million, a record price. They want the money to help their causes. Who bought it, and what are they going to do with it? Find out at extremegenes.com. And coming up next, researcher John Tippett's on his wild ride adventure researching his father's Alaskan plane crash survival during World War II on Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, and extremegenes.com. Hey, welcome back to Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, and extremegenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And in studio with me today is John Tippett. And John is a guy after my own heart in a certain way. He had kind of a similar circumstance, losing his dad young when dad was in his 50s. And he kind of did what I did, and that is started to research his life because later on I came to realize how little I had known about him. I lost my dad at 17. John, how old were you when you lost yours?
I was 27 when my dad passed away.
And I think this is kind of a universal thing for a lot of people who may have lost somebody they loved young. And, you know, they work on getting over it and the new life without that person. But then later on, you get your own family, and you start to talk to younger siblings or cousins, and you start to realize, my gosh, there's a lot we don't know about this person. In your case, you were the older sibling.
Yes, I was, and I realized how little, A, my siblings knew.
Yes.
Who were younger, and B, certainly our grandchildren, their grandchildren, our children, and their great-grandchildren who were coming into this world didn't know anything.
Nothing at all. And so you went about what I did, which was to write some books. Now, I just wrote my books for my family because I figure, you know what, Dad's got a great life story, very interesting, but nonetheless, it's something I want to spread around to them, and I wouldn't have ever thought to actually go out and publish it. You kind of started that way. Let's go through the process you went through, because now you started this later in life?
I did, about 12, 15 years ago. I wrote an early chapter around the circumstances of my dad's funeral, which was kind of a special occasion for our family. I wrote that. I wrote about dad's years in the Navy in the 30s. I wrote about his years growing up, mother's years growing up. So I wrote several different chapters, just like you did, for family purposes, put a lot of the family pictures in with text and subtitles so that people would know the circumstances of the pictures.
Did you still have mom around as a resource for some of this?
No, mother passed away just a couple years after dad, and she had been ill for a long time, so her story wasn't really recorded either. So I had to work from third-party sources, family albums, newspaper articles where I could find them. I interviewed people who knew them. I did
right.
A lot of third-party sourcing because there was no diary, no journal per se to start with.
Well, have you wound up using a lot of digitized newspapers?
Yes, yes. And, of course, when I started this some years ago, it was microfiche, and it was terrible stuff to read. Yes, very difficult.
And so I would imagine your family kind of embraced this pretty quickly. They were excited about what you were finding and what you were doing.
Yes, my brothers and sisters particularly have been very grateful. And then the grandchildren of my parents gradually have understood more about people that they didn't know at all. So it's been a great family experience. And then a certain portion of the story was an unusual story in 1943 when Dad was lost in an airplane crash in Alaska. That portion actually grew into a form that I really decided I had to put into a book.
Now, he was lost but not killed.
No. He was one of four survivors of an airplane crash in southeast Alaska, January of 1943, and survived 29 days in the wilderness, made his way out finally and was rescued. But, yes, that story I turned into a book.
And that was when you were a young child.
I was two, living in Anchorage. I had been born in Anchorage, and I was 2 years old.
So you had no recollection of that. It was just obviously a family story that everybody knew about, and wow, look what Dad did.
Yes, but it's funny. Everybody knew pieces, but putting the whole thing back in a form for family history,
right,
for family. We all discovered things, and I certainly discovered a lot that none of us even knew about, elements of the story we'd never heard.
Now, what were some of the sources for those things?
Lots of fun sources. People who had firsthand experiences. One fellow described going to visit my mother when Dad had been lost for a long time, saying, you know, you got to move. Alaska's no place for a widow. And she's describing Joe's coming home, and I'm staying here until he. But that kind of first-person account was one source. A lot of newspaper articles. National Archives in Washington, D.C. I actually read the ship log of the little boat that actually rescued Dad after 29 days.
Who would know that was even out there? You know, this is the thing, because in writing these stories, developing the sources is the adventure, if you will.
Oh,
because
it is
there's the obvious stuff for any kind of research, you know, your census stuff and county histories and all that. But boy, when you get into the obscure, the hard to get, well, you really value and treasure those things. And when the mail comes, maybe, you know, if it's done as a snail mail piece, it's exciting.
I went to a museum in Alaska. Somebody said there's a box of old pictures in here. You might want to go through these pictures and see if you find any of interest. I found the picture of a rock quarry, which is very significant to the fifth day of Dad's loss. I have not found other pictures of any rock quarries ever, and I'm finding the one that really matters to me.
Oh, the serendipity coming into play.
Oh, wonderful. And I did another one where I was in the back of another museum, and somebody said there's a box of old Civil Aeronautics Administration. That was the government agency that Dad worked for. There's their mimeographed newsletters. So you may want to go through these from the 40s. I went through them and found a wonderful account from Dad after he's rescued from the accident. And it's in his firsthand voice, something I'd never seen before. And another one of those wonderful experiences, and you'd relate to this. There was a young lady on the airplane who ended up dying on the second day. And so when I had the book done in a relatively final form, my wife said, we still don't have enough in here about Susan Botzer. We don't know enough about Susan. And so she says, let me get on the phone. And so she gets on the phone the next day or two. She calls this little town in Morristown, South Dakota, and she gets a hold of the town clerk. And she says, well, how about the school library? Oh, we long ago closed our high school. Then my wife says, well, what about the yearbook from the year that Susan might have been there in school? Oh, we never had yearbooks. We were too poor for yearbooks. Anyway, they go on through all of Bonnie's list, and they're not getting anything.
No.
This little town clerk says, but I have a 90-year-old father-in-law still living here in town, and maybe he knows something. I get home that night. My wife talks to me about the story. I said, 90? That's how old Susan would be. Give or take a year, she's the same age as this guy. So she talks to the guy the next day. The sequence continues. We find family members of the Susan, because the guy knew the family members. We find a letter that my dad had written to the Botzer family after he's rescued, explaining the circumstances of Susan's death. She was the one death as an immediate result of the accident. But anyway, we find wonderful things as a sequence of events in the research process, the kind of small miracles you describe.
Well, and, you know, that's the exciting part about this is the thing that gets in your main line, you know.
Oh, yes, it does.
Once you start.
It's just wonderful. I just found some things that I just never imagined existed, some wonderful firsthand accounts, several people besides the one I mentioned who had been with Mother at different points over the time Dad was lost. And they're telling the story of their interactions with Mother. Those were great adventures.
We're talking to John Tippetts, author of a book called Hearts of Courage, which is a family history about his dad, who he lost young, and the process that he went through in doing this. And, you know, John, I was thinking about some of the things you're saying, and I think I relate to it to some extent, because I started mine in the 90s. And then, of course, I had it finished, and the kids had all their copies, even as they were young and still living at home. And then you start finding more things. It's like, oh, I got to do a new version. Because, first of all, the technology makes for better-looking books and for more sources and more news and more pictures. And so I've now revised that thing twice, and the book's 500 pages long, and there's three volumes. At what point did you say with this story? Because, obviously, you keep finding all kinds of minutiae through people like you just described. At what point do you say, that's it, the book is finished? Or are you going to have to do an addendum, or are you going to have to revise it?
Well, you have to have a deadline. That's the one thing you did learn. I did set a deadline. I wanted to finish it before I retired. I had a 42-year career with American. I was planning to retire in 2008. I'd been doing this off and on for 8 or 10 years to that point. I just decided I wanted to finish it before I retired and have it done. I got it done in 2008. There's been some wonderful miracles since that didn't get into the book.
Sure.
I'll tell you about that another time, perhaps. But, yeah, I found a professional publisher who would help me do it as a published document.
You're going to try to sell basically the story to the public. Let them hear your dad's story, because it was an amazing thing.
Well, yes. Yeah, so it got to a point there were so many people who asked if they could have a copy when I got done that it had to be in a form that you could put it in the book form. And the publisher helped me do it, helped me lay it out. It is technically self-published, but I've had several thousand copies out now in the marketplace. I tell the story to different audiences as I travel around the country. People will want me to sign a copy of the book, and it has had a great ride since. And as I say, there's been many discoveries since I told the story, since I wrote it. So it's continuing adventure. It's a continuing adventure.
Maybe you've had the same experience I have, and that is I feel right now I know my father better now than I did when he was living, because I know his past. I found things that I had never realized, not just stories that were told to me by other folks who knew him, but finding things on YouTube from the 30s with him in it, finding digitized newspaper stories. And suddenly there's a connection that you didn't have when he was living.
You know, I had one of those experiences in 1999. I'm flying on an airplane. The airplane is full. I had authority to fly in a cockpit. This was before 2001. I got a seat up there with a pilot. We're flying over a little town down in southern Utah called Price. I'm saying my dad went to his senior year of high school there. The pilot says so does his dad. It turns out when we started putting stories together, I found out more about my dad's senior year. His father's older brother had been in the class with my dad. They had been in plays together. They had spent times together. Dad would spend nights at their house. And when he did, one of the kids slept on the floor, and he remembered very vividly my dad. So, you know,
the people you would just run into.
Yeah. And because the plane was over full, I'm flying in the cockpit behind the pilot.
Just sitting there.
Yep.
Isn't that unbelievable?
Wonderful experience.
Well, and the process is such a joy, and what you're describing is terrific. I want to hear, though, more about what happened after you finished the book. The book's been out for how long now?
Since 2008.
I want to hear about what happened after the book came out, some of the things you found, how you're dealing with that. When we return with John Tippetts coming up next on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. You found us, Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. We're talking to John Tippetts. He's written a book called Hearts of Courage. It's about his dad, but I think what we're most interested in has been the process by which he went to discover his dad's life and an amazing adventure. He was lost in the wilderness in Alaska, and he died when you were still a young man, and your siblings were quite a bit younger, and you all realized what I did when I lost my dad young. Gee, we just don't know that much.
I had had some experiences with my parents as adults, but most of my siblings hadn't. And even what we had, we remembered differently, and we remembered inaccurately or very, very minimally.
So you wrote your book. You made it for the family first. Then you got it published.
Yes, in 2008.
And you do lectures on it, and you enjoy that. You've got that rebonding going on. But then you ran into the same kind of thing that I did when I wrote my book. Now, I didn't publish it for the public. I just made them for the family. They're big, full, beautiful books. I'm very pleased with them. But you reach a point afterwards, the spigot doesn't turn off. The information still continues to flow because there are new sources coming out all the time. And now it's like, well, do I revise? Do I reprint? Do I, you know, what do I do with that? So I'm going to ask you, how have you managed that? Because I know you haven't quit looking.
Oh, you don't have to look. They come to you.
Yes.
You know, one of the early ones, I get a phone call from a lady who had discovered the book and read Hearts of Courage. And she said, you know, my uncle was involved in that story. He was in the Coast Guard Reserve.
How many people were in the plane crash? How many survived?
There was a total of six in the plane. A young lady died on a second day after the crash.
Right,
it was in Boston, which I mentioned to you in the other segment. The pilot on day five, after hearing explosion from that rock quarry that I mentioned previously.
Yes.
He heads out thinking he's close to that rock quarry. It turns out in the cold it's some 30 miles away. Anyway, he dies of exposure. They ultimately find his body about a month later. But four others do survive. Dad and three others survive.
Wow. What a miracle.
So it's a great story
Not just
of
that,
survival.
That four survived, that anybody survived.
Oh, very much
at
so.
At so many levels. Yeah, how cold did it get?
Well, probably down in the 20s to 40 below to zero at cold in the night in the top of the mountain. But generally in southeast Alaska, it more hovers around freezing. You get snow and ice, you know, at the top of the mountain.
Sometimes so igloos.
Some days it'll turn into rain. So the misery was variable. How's that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They were able to make igloos, though, to stay,
no,
stay
the,
warm
and
protected?
For most of the time they were lost, the first almost 2.5-3 weeks, they were on the mountainside, and they made kind of a snow cave underneath the left wing of the airplane. So they brought sleeping bags and mattresses and – not mattresses, seat cushions and clothing out of the airplane and sort of made this snow cave underneath the wing of the airplane. That's where they stayed for almost 3 weeks.
Food?
Every little meal is an adventure. There were some slight provisions on the airplane that they spread out as long as they could. At one point, they shot some grouse and had grouse. At another point, they shoot some crows and have crows. At another point, they shoot a squirrel and have squirrel soup. And then they have some mussels off a beach. But almost every meal is one that you can recollect and identify with. But Dad has one unusual experience. He goes back into the airplane one day before they go down off the mountain, and he goes through the airplane picking up crumbs of bread and little pieces of apple and grapes that they'd had from a lunch before the plane had crashed. And so he remembers savoring those little teeny morsels of food that had been left over. So, yes, there's this sequence of little bits of food for 30 days.
So talk about, again, what some of the other things that happened. You ran into somebody's uncle who had been part of the rescue team.
Yes, that was
one. As a result
one,
of the book.
That was one. Another one, nephew, is telling my story in a Sunday school class, and somebody raises his hand. Their grandfather had been there with my mother when she had learned of the story. What a sequence. And so I get this guy's personal journal, who was with my mother when she learned that Dad was lost, and he's describing her anguish and distraught. So she was very, very upset. So the resolve that she had 3 or 4 weeks later when she knew Dad was going to survive was a contrast to how distraught she was when she first heard that he was lost. And this guy describes how he had decided he was never coming back, and he couldn't persuade Alta that he was never coming back. So that was a nice piece to find. Another one, I get another call from somebody who had found the book and read it and said his dad was involved. He was in the Coast Guard as well. He was involved on the rescue of the last two survivors when Dad and Cutting went back to get the two that they'd left behind. So I went to interview this guy. He lived on Whidbey Island in the Seattle area. And I'm interviewing him, and he says, I was probably going back to find two dead men. And then I find out your dad and Mr. Cutting are going to go with me, and I'm probably going to have four dead men. I was angry. And he's still at 88 years old, was still angry that he had these four dead men he was going to be responsible for. His name was Fred Hill, but he was in charge of the shore party, putting all of the supplies and things together to go in to find the last two.
So if you were to give advice to people and say, look, you know, you want to pursue your parents, your grandparents, I guess it really doesn't matter the generation because there's still a lot of materials out, but especially when there's the possibility of living people still around who might have some recollection of that, what advice would you give?
Do it now. Do it now. The urgency of it is of several of these people that I had in either preparing before writing the book and or subsequent now are gone. The time passes quickly. In the last 12, 15 years, I've lost a number of people that I interviewed. I interviewed one little lady who grew up with my mother. She had some wonderful memories, and she's long gone now. I've interviewed others who have also passed away. I interviewed one man who, again, after I did the story, he said, he lived in Boise, Idaho, and he said, I was supposed to be on that airplane that day. I couldn't get my ration card for my gasoline. I got to Seattle late. I got there just after the airplane was left and the hangar was empty. He, to this day, is grateful he missed the airplane that day. Now, he passed away just a year or so ago. He was 100 years old. He had worked parallel with my dad before and after the accident, so he really knew Dad. He knew the story. He knew it from having missed the airplane. So find them when you can. Have those interviews. Record what you can. Write it down and save it.
Yeah, and you don't have to publish it for the public, but make it for your family at least. Have an archives that you create, whether it's a digital archive or a physical one.
I have a great big container from Container Store that I've stuffed with stuff about my mother's youth from third-party sources that I will ultimately write a nice story about her youth growing up.
When are you going to get to your grandparents, John?
you know, I think in doing my mother's youth, I will catch a lot of my grandparents on one side anyway. Yes.
You might. John Tippetts, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And coming up next, Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, our preservation authority, talking about a little alphabet soup, AVI, MOV. What does it mean? When do you use it? He'll tell you next on Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com. Hey, welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And in studio with us today, it's Tom Perry, our preservation authority from TMCPlace.com. Welcome back, Tom. Today we've got another question from AskTom@TMCPlace.com. AVI or MOV? We're talking about saving film and videotapes. What is the difference between the two? What do these things mean? Let's just go to the most fundamental.
Okay, back in the day, which could have been 3 weeks ago,
right?
Because technology changes so fast.
It does.
When people came into the store and wanted film transferred or video transferred, the first question we would ask, PC or Mac? And if they were a PC, usually we went with AVIs. If they were a Mac, we went with MOVs. And there's actually two theories to this. A Mac will read almost anything, but a PC won't. So we'd do AVIs for PCs, even though they were bigger files. The compression isn't as good. The quality, we don't feel, was as good. But they had to go with a PC. They had to go with AVIs, but not anymore.
And so now things are changing again.
Exactly. So in the last 5 minutes,
yeah.
We're now MOVs. Everybody can now do MOVs because there's some new software out. In fact, they just did a test with different people, interviewed people, what they use for editing and stuff. And the top 10 programs for Windows now is CyberLink, Corel, Adobe Premiere Elements, Magic, Roxio, Pinnacle, Sony, Nero, Movie Plus, and the VideoPad. And the one that came out number one is an incredible program. It's made by CyberLink, and it's called PowerDirector. And the thing is, it's $49.95.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Nope. So whether you go to a local store or find someplace on the internet, you can just Google and go and buy it. I mean, $49.95 for a program that will let you edit either MOVs, AVIs, and even MP4s on a PC. It's revolutionary. It's awesome.
Now, everyone can take advantage of this MOV format. There are certain advantages here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the size is so much smaller, but the quality is, you know, incredible.
So you can, this is easier for editing then.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And you got quality compression.
Exactly.
That you didn't have before. So are we saying goodbye to AVI then?
I don't know if they'll ever say goodbye to it. People are always going to want AVIs for certain things. But as far as, you know, most of our listeners are concerned, MOV is the way to go. That's what I would do myself. I would do MOVs. I've always been an Apple guy. I love MOVs. And now that the PC people, through programs like this new PowerDirector, they can take advantage of the MOVs. And it's a lot less hard disk space that they have to use up. As far as I'm concerned, there's no downsides to MOVs. They're awesome.
So for Apple computers, what would you recommend as far as editing goes?
They can use, usually they come with iMovie free out of the box, which is a great program. If they want to get something better, they can use Final Cut Pro. Or what a lot of people are doing is they're going back to Adobe Premiere. Adobe Premiere kind of had a falling out with Apple and kind of went away, but now it's back and it's part of the Adobe suites. And if I was going to start out and I wasn't married to any specific program, I would probably go the Adobe way just because they have so many different programs that tie into each other to be able to use stuff. I'd probably go to Adobe Premiere.
And you've got to make sure that the system requirements match these things, right?
Exactly. That's where a lot of people make mistakes. They have an old PC that they got out or their kids went to college, and so you know, they're going to go use their kid's computer, and they go and find a nice program. They go and buy it, they download it, and they have nothing but problems because you need to go out and make sure your processor is the right speed, you have enough memory, and more is always better. When you go to their site and it says you need this kind of a computer, this kind of a processor, this much memory, yada, 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 that's the minimum requirements. Don't think, oh, okay, you know, I can do with this. Always get more, especially memory. Memory is so inexpensive nowadays. Just as much as you can afford, do it, and you'll be so glad you did.
You know, I have so much memory on my computer, and you are so right. I never worry about it. It's amazing how much I put on there, and every time I look, it's just such a little percentage of what we've got, and it's such a good, secure feeling.
Oh, it is. If you don't have enough memory or you're low on memory, it will absolutely drive you crazy. Don't let your computer have Alzheimer's.
We're talking to Tom Perry. He's our preservation specialist from TMCPlace.com on Extreme Genes Family History Radio. And what else are you going to tell us about today, Tom?
Okay, one thing people have asked about is different kind of hard drives. Most of our listeners probably already know the difference between HDD, which is standard hard drive, and the SSHDD, which are solid-state hard drives. And the neat thing about solid-state hard drives, they are instant. You don't wait for the thing to spin up. When you're doing editing and stuff, it is so much faster. They are awesome. They're really expensive for external ones right now. A decent external one, you know, you can spend $1,000 for 2 terabytes.
Wow.
But you can get internal ones for a lot less money. So if you have a tower, you can get an internal one. If you're buying a new computer, I really recommend, if you can afford it, go with a solid-state hard drive. They are so quick. When you power on your computer, it's like before you get your finger off the button, it's up and ready to rock and roll. It's that fast.
Now, I remember when you took care of my old family movies from the home movies from the 50s and 60s.
Exactly.
You gave them back to me on an external hard drive.
Right.
And the reason for that is because you converted them each into JPEGs, right? So
exactly.
It's kind of a large file. So I could go through and actually cut out individual photographs from it, some that are absolutely amazing and priceless because, you know, they were never taken with the stills. So there are a lot of reasons for having an external hard drive.
Oh, yeah. Oh, external hard drives are absolutely awesome. They're so convenient. In fact, they're getting so nice, you can get the little thumb drives that go on your keychain. And, I mean, 64 gigs on a keychain. I mean, if you have MP4s, that's hours and hours of content. It's just incredible.
And I guess that brings up the question, do you need more than one hard drive?
Oh, absolutely. And the thing you need to be so careful with is don't have all these hard drives at one place. If your house burns down, it's probably going to burn every room. So having one in the bedroom and one in your office, it's not going to do you any good. The cloud's a good way to store stuff, but don't rely just on the cloud. It's such new technology, we don't know what the horror stories are going to be yet. So what I always recommend people do is when you're editing on your computer, great, but as soon as you're done, go and take your hard drive, put it in a little fireproof safe or a gun safe or something like that, just in case, you know, the bad thing happens. We had an example where we had a customer came in and brought, you know, videotapes, film, all kinds of stuff, and we transferred them all to DVD. This has been several years ago before, you know, we did a lot of hard drives. And he had some copies made, luckily for him. He had to go to Seattle over the weekend, and I told him, as I tell all of our customers, make sure you put your masters in a fireproof safe or a gun safe so that if something happens to your duplicates, you can go back to your masters. When I get back on Monday, I'll do that. While he was gone, his house burnt to the ground.
Oh.
By a miracle, between his masters and his duplicates, we were able to put a full set together. Some of the masters were totally destroyed. Some of the duplicates were totally destroyed. But just, you know, he must be living right or something because we were able to totally recreate his entire files from those. Whereas if he wouldn't have made the duplicates, his tapes were totally destroyed. All of his tapes were gone.
Oh.
So he was able to have a full set. And if he wouldn't have done that, he would have lost.
So even the duplication within the fire salvaged what he had.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. Some masters survived. Some duplicates survived. So you need to be really, really careful. Don't ever put off tomorrow thinking, oh, I'll take care of this tomorrow, or, you know, I'm editing tonight, I'm going to be editing in the morning, I don't need to put it away in the safe tonight. Don't ever do that. It takes you 5 minutes to do that at the longest, and you'll just sleep more comfortable, and if something happens, whether it's a flood, you know, a hurricane or whatever, you're going to be able to keep it. You know, we had a story that was back in New Orleans when they had the big hurricane come through, and this lady thought she was safe because she had all of her pictures. She had them saved on CD at her house. She had them at her daughter's house that lived a few miles away. And the photographer had them. Well, they all lived in New Orleans. All of them lost everything. She lost everything.
Wow.
No wedding pictures at all. Her daughter's home was destroyed. Her home was destroyed. The photographer's home was destroyed. Everybody lost it. So when you make duplicates, put them in a safety deposit box, put them in a fireproof safe, send them to relatives, you know, and say, hey, will you just hang on to this for me? And hopefully you'll never need it. But people that take that extra time and make that effort to do that will be, you know, greatly blessed for it.
Well, it's just a great example of duplication, and like you say, get it out of town, not just out of the building, but out of town.
Oh, yeah, because you have a natural disaster. You never know. And don't always rely that, oh, a safety deposit box, I only need one copy there. Look what happened at 9/11.
Yeah.
Those safety deposit boxes that were like, I don't remember, like 40, 50 feet below ground, they were all
destroyed.
All, yeah, all of them.
Yeah.
You know,
isn't
totally
that
destroyed, amazing?
Obviously, we're talking about the most extreme losses you can think of, but still, it is possible.
Right.
And it's good to know.
It doesn't matter how extreme of a loss it is. If it happens to you,
yeah,
it's a loss.
It's
so
your
it doesn't
loss.
Matter whether
exactly.
It, yeah, the chances are slim or not. Take care of your stuff. Keep it around. You know, send it out of state, you know, whatever you can to make sure it's short. Put it on the cloud. Don't ever rely on one backup source. Spread it out as much as you can.
All right. He's Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. If you got a question for Tom, a topic you want us to discuss, we'd love to hear from you. Just ask Tom at TMCPlace.com. That's his email, and he'll be happy to get back to you, and we'll be happy to share it. And Tom, we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. We'll see you then.
Hey, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us on another episode of Extreme Genes Family History Radio. Thanks to John Tippetts for coming in and sharing the story of his dad's survival in the Alaskan tundra following a plane crash during World War II. By the way, that's our poll question this week. Do you have a relative, maybe you yourself, was ever in a plane crash or train crash? We've had both in my family. Take care, and remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.